Okay, before we proceed to the next section, I want to see if there are any questions about both, you know, what this means in, you know, sort of global context, and also, you know, what do I need to know about this for purposes of the exam? I've tried to say as much as I can about that, but if you're left with some lingering questions or uncertainties. Okay. Well, obviously today we have our regular Wednesday Q&A session at 11, so we can do that then as well. Okay. Now switching to the third section of chapter 3, recalling where we've been, the first section did an inventory of the different types of damages. The middle section looked at who, in addition to the immediate victim, was entitled to compensation. Now, in section 3, we take up a even more sort of miscellaneous set of issues about calculating the size of the award. Assuming we've decided this person gets to recover, these are the types of damages they get to recover. Now, how do we go about putting a number on it? And I made reference previously to this case of Fortman versus Hemco Inc., where the defendant made a defective product, this automobile with outward opening doors that resulted in injury to Nicole Fortman, such that she is rendered. She's got a 5-year-old's mental state, is confined to a wheelchair, I think, or bedridden, has to have a specially equipped van, wheelchair, other medical appliances. They say she's going to live for 70.9 years. Again, making the best guess they can with someone in her condition. And what's the jury's award of damages in this case? The economic losses were calculated at 17.7. We'll round that to 18 million. And in addition, the jury awarded 6 million in non-economic damages. The defendant challenges this award as being too much, and by what standard does the court decide whether this is within the range of an acceptable jury verdict? What's the standard the court's going to use? Well, the court does use. Ms. Reed? Okay. And how do we know that? Okay, the evidence with respect to, you know, how severe is her injury. For the economic damages, we look at the severity of injury, and then what does the plaintiff offer in terms of how do we get to $18 million? You have expert medical witnesses who tell you how they evaluated the likely medical future. You know, if I were, in some cases, they may actually be Nicole's doctor, or I am, or if I were her doctor, I would expect that she would need this kind of medical care for this many years, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have an economist who says, okay, here's the pattern over the last 30 years of how much it costs to take care of a person with this kind of injury, and I would expect, you know, going out to age 71, that the cost by the year 2040, 2050, whenever it is we're projecting this, the costs look sort of like Mount Everest at that point. What did the defendant offer by way of counter testimony? Nada. How could that be? What's going on here? Malpractice? Seems unlikely that the defendant said, oh, were we supposed to bring an economist to this thing? The defendant must have consciously chosen not to offer testimony of their own. Why? Mr. Lobach? There's always this problem for defendants. You know, it's sort of the classic, if I'm the criminal defense attorney and I tell the jury, you know, my client is innocent, but, oh, by the way, if he's guilty, it's second degree rather than first degree. You know, it's hard for me to make that argument about the degree of punishment without conceding, in effect, well, yeah, I need to talk about this because you're probably going to find my client guilty. You know, similarly, how do I talk about the amount of damages without reinforcing the idea that there's going to be damages at all? Moreover, what could my own experts bring to the party, so to speak? If my experts are arguing over the data drawn from, you know, I think the period from 1964 to 1967 was aberrational, that the longer trend line of economic, you know, if that's the substance of my expert's testimony, quibbling over the details of whether we use a 0.08 or a 0.075, you know, multiplier for the relationship between consumer confidence and the market. Well, gee, if that's what we're going to be arguing about, again, I only reinforce the idea that this is the way we calculate the award. The jury's only going to have reinforced in their mind the idea that this is a fair way to go about computing the award. The defendant took a gamble that either they could beat the rap, that they could persuade the jury that this product was not defective and that there shouldn't be a recovery at all. And even on the issue of damages, if I were the defense lawyer in a case like this and we had made the decision we're not going to argue damages, we're not going to say it should be $6.8 million instead of $18 million, even so, I'm going to make use of the argument in this way. I would say, ladies and gentlemen, Jeremy, you heard a day and a half of testimony on, you know, the economist who testified. Of course, you heard my cross-examination. I called into question lots of things. But let's sort of stand back and take the larger perspective here. This lawyer over here, I'm not going to point to Nicole Fortman in her wheelchair. I'm going to point to the lawyer over there who says he says that to fairly compensate Nicole Fortman, it's going to take $18 million. $18 million is, you could put that in the bank and at 2% interest every year, you'd have $360,000. Wouldn't you? No. You'd have 30, what do you know? You'd have $360,000. At 2% interest, you have $360,000. Now, the testimony here is it's going to cost $125,000 to take care of her every year. Where's this $360,000 going to go? Something wrong here, ladies and gentlemen. And I would submit to you that you should no more believe the plaintiff's lawyer on liability. You know, when they tell you this is a defective product, you should no more believe that than you could trust the plaintiff's lawyer in telling you that it's going to take $18 million to compensate. So I can attack sort of to say, let's see the big picture here. There's something really wrong with this picture. They're not giving you the straight scoop here. And for the very same reason, I think you ought to reject, you know, and then I go into my line about what's wrong with their case on liability. That's, at least I've used somehow, I've responded somehow to say this whole thing about damages is came out of, it's not drawn from the real world. Sure, this economist, you'll recall, you know, how much this economist is getting paid. This economist is getting $104,000. It's already billed and collected from the plaintiff's lawyers, $104,000. This is the best testimony money can buy. Now, again, you know, I can attack, but am I going to offer instead my own economist, whom I've paid a mere $42,000? You know, is that the kind of game I'm going to play? I don't think so. But again, the defendant chose to take this gamble, and the court looks at the defendant and says, you took your gamble and you lost. The jury had evidence upon which they could find, it's not the only verdict they could have reached, but there was evidence upon which they could find that it's going to cost $18 million just to keep her medically treated for the rest of her natural life. By comparison, the $6 million in non-economic damages doesn't look like such a big deal. Standing by itself, it's a lot of money, and particularly with Nicole, who's got the mental age of a... Again, if you think about what it's going to take to compensate. Okay, we put the $5 million in the bank and a 2% interest, and you probably could get a better return than that, but even the most modest thing, you put $6 million in the bank, you draw 2% interest, that's $120,000 a year just for pain and suffering. Now, of course, we're forgetting about the fact the lawyer's going to take that all away. But in theory, for purposes of our discussion here, the $6 million is available after we paid for all the medical expenses and everything just to provide compensation for the fact that she's 5 years old and she'll never be more than 5 years old mentally, emotionally, and so forth. She has all these physical limitations. We can buy her a swimming pool. We can take her to Disneyland. We can do these things that will in some way compensate for the fact that she'll never drive a car. She'll never go to the prom. She'll never run in a race. She'll never, be able to cook a meal or all the things you could list that now, because of the defendant's negligence, she won't be able to do. And, yeah, does going to Disneyland and having a swimming pool compensate for not being able to do those things? No way, but at least it's something. Is that too much? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury? Well, again, the court is going to say, is there substantial evidence to support the $6 million award? Yeah, there's evidence to support that. If it were $20 million, $50 million, $100 million, how much, where do we find the point at which it's too much? I don't know. Court doesn't know either, but $6 million isn't bad. It isn't out of the ballpark. So again, the defendant is stuck in this situation where tain't fair. The defendant looks at this case and says, I make automobiles. Most of my automobiles are fine. One bad accident costs us $24 million. If it weren't an automobile manufacturer, suppose it's the city of Spokane or the county. You know, somebody makes a mistake. Some guy in a dump truck, you know, backs over somebody, or, you know, it's the lady at Walmart, and, you know, she falls off the curb and a truck runs over, or what, you know, things happen. Okay, we make mistakes. That costs us $20 million. You realize what that does to our budget? But, legally speaking, the question is, for the appellate court, when an award like that is made, is there substantial evidence to support the verdict? If there is, we let the verdict stand. And again, the defendant doesn't have very good options. No wonder defendants are inclined to go run to the legislature most of the time, because only in the legislature can they get a fair hearing. Their hands are tied behind their back talking to a jury, because the only way they can really make their case is to seemingly discount the injury to this plaintiff. They run the risk of looking like really hard-hearted jerks to the jury, and they're not going to do that. But they do feel as though the system as a whole is just a slot machine for the plaintiff's bar. That's the defendant's feeling about the way the system works. Okay, now we see, in part, the response. Defendants do have friends in the legislature. Defendants, large institutions, companies, manufacturers, you know, professional associations, the American Medical Association, et cetera, they have friends, they have money to contribute to political campaigns. They have, you know, Bill Frist is the, isn't he the majority leader in the Senate? You know, he's a surgeon, and he's very sympathetic to the cause of medical malpractice reform. So you see stuff like Fine versus Permanente. And so I want to look at these sort of, this is a piece of tort reform legislation, and let's take a look at that and how it works. There's a fair amount of constitutional law here. I don't want to get too far into it, but constitutional law has an impact on tort law, because many times courts will, as we'll see in Chapter 7, courts will use constitutional principles to strike down legislation, particularly tort reform legislation, that the courts think infringe upon constitutional rights. So who can tell us about Fine versus Permanente? Ms. Russell. Why'd they do that? Yes. This statute, MICRA, which says leave the economic damages alone, but if there is an award of non-economic damages that exceeds $250,000, you chop off the top of it, trim it down, so that you, or another way of saying it is, there's a cap on non-economic damages at $250,000. So the jury awards Mr. Fine how much in economic damages? Well, no, more than that. It's like 500, 600, somewhere in that range. I think by the time you add the, what's that? Okay, by the time you add all the other stuff together here, it's somewhere in this range. Just order of magnitude is all I'm really interested in. Non-economic damages, the jury said, again, Mr. Fine was the victim of medical malpractice. As a result of this, he suffers economic loss, but he also has pain and suffering. Now he has this, you know, untreated or uncured heart condition, and as a result of that, he can't do lots of things, and he's in, you know, pain and suffering and so forth. The jury said, we think $500,000 is the right amount of compensation, but the court says, sorry, pursuant to the statute, the maximum you get there is $250,000. Okay, so the plaintiff now appeals that award and says, the legislature could not pass such a statute. On what basis does the plaintiff say that the it's not that the legislature couldn't do it, but it's the court should ignore that statute in effect? Why? What are the arguments for refusing to apply this limitation in MICRA? Okay. But on what basis? Okay. And that's all part of the argument, but I want to get the sort of category that this fits in. On what basis can a judge, looking at a statute from the legislature says to the court, thou shalt reduce the award from $500,000 to $250,000. On what basis can a judge say to the legislature, no, I won't do that? What, by what authority? What's that? Yes, if it's on, we judges and you, legislature, report to a higher authority. The higher authority is the Constitution, which governs both of us. You, legislature, as well as we judges, have to follow the Constitution. Now, you know, going to questions like Lawrence versus Texas or the affirmative action cases, who says what the Constitution tells us we can do or can't do? We judges say what the Constitution says. So in that sense, the legislature and the judges, though they are both ruled by the Constitution, the Constitution is what the judges say it is. So to the extent that the judges misread or misunderstand the Constitution, there is no higher authority. But when in this case the plaintiffs ask the court to overturn the statute, they cite particular provisions of the Constitution that the plaintiffs claim the legislature violated. And what are these provisions of the Constitution? Mr. Redmond? Okay, that's the first one. Let's talk about that. And again, the Equal Protection Clause is found in the 14th Amendment. And some of you probably studied this in college or are otherwise familiar with it. To others of you, it's sort of new stuff. But again, the 14th Amendment says no state may deprive a citizen of, or any, may deprive any person of equal protection of the laws. Now, what exactly does the 14th Amendment mean when it says you can't deprive people of equal protection? There's a historical debate about this. There's also, as you may know, the whole idea of incorporation. That, for example, when we read the First Amendment, the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, nor shall it abridge the freedom of the press or the right to assemble, and so forth and so on. The First Amendment addresses, apparently, Congress shall make no law. Well, that has been understood to apply not just to Congress, but to the executive as well. The executive can't establish a religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof or abridge the freedom of speech. Not only that, but the 14th Amendment, when the 14th Amendment says no citizen may be deprived of the privileges and immunities of citizenship and no person may be deprived of equal protection of the laws, they say that that incorporated the protections of the First Amendment and now applied them to the states. And there's a whole debate about whether incorporation is a legitimate way to apply the First Amendment and the other protections of the Bill of Rights to the states. By now, it's well-settled constitutional law, but it's still debated by scholars as to whether maybe we took a wrong turn in thinking that the 14th Amendment was intended to do this whole business of incorporation. Some people claim the 14th Amendment was very narrow. Some people claim it's very broad. It's a whole debate. Now, what do we mean here? Equal protection of the laws. How is Mr. Fine being treated unequally? Okay. But before we, and that's all relevant, but before we get there, I need to know, how is he being discriminated against? That's the whole idea of violation of the Equal Protection Clause says, I've been discriminated against. In what respect has he been discriminated against? Compared to whom? He's being treated worse than or other people in California who suffer other kinds of injuries. So if he'd been hit, if the doctor in this case had hit him in an intersection, Mr. Fine would get a full recovery. Nobody would reduce his award. But because the doctor hit him, so to speak, on the operating table rather than hitting him in an intersection, we're going to give him less money. And he says, this is discrimination. You're treating, in effect, doctors better than you're treating people who drive cars. Now, this raises the whole question of, well, okay, there are differences in the law. Different people do get, after all, people who drive tankers full of gasoline are treated differently from people who drive tankers full of milk or, you know, drive cars. We hold one strictly liable, the other one is held to a standard of reasonable care. Is there something wrong with discrimination? I mean, if discrimination means different treatment, can we never treat people differently? That's not quite. It turns out there's discrimination and there's discrimination. We look to the kind, on what basis are you being treated differently? And we have these three tiers of discrimination, a little bit like, you know, Papa Bear's porridge, Mama Bear's porridge, and Baby Bear's porridge, but not exactly like that. There is a form of discrimination which we subject to so-called strict scrutiny. What kind of discrimination do we say has to meet the test of strict scrutiny? Such as? Yes, race is the biggie. There's also stuff about ethnicity and other categories. In fact, as I recall, in Lawrence versus Texas, there is they believe that the discrimination against the defendants in that case were that it had to pass strict scrutiny. Yeah. Well, this is one of the things people criticize about from the 14th Amendment, which says simply everybody's entitled to equal protection of the laws. The courts have designed this three-tiered system, and everybody says, well, where did that come from? Not everybody, but you know, you can legitimately ask, by what authority did the Supreme Court kind of invent this three-tiered system? Again, just so we have this, let's identify and then let's talk about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Again, the idea you use this term suspect classification. Whenever there is discrimination on the basis of race, our antenna go way up, that we're now on a heightened alert. We're very suspicious. This is a suspect classification. When people make classifications based on race, you better have a really, really good reason to do that. We subject it to strict scrutiny because we're very afraid that this is being done for illegitimate purposes. However, there are situations in which we say discrimination based on race could be justified. And I believe in the, I'm trying to think of the guy's name, Bollinger. Bollinger versus whoever the plaintiff was in the University of Michigan case, the affirmative action case, I believe the court, I can't remember it, I think the court said this passes strict scrutiny because the interest of having a diverse student body and of helping to alleviate the effects of past discrimination, that is a compelling state interest that justifies treating people differently because of their race. But again, we subject it to this very strict scrutiny. Now, at the bottom of the food chain here would be discrimination, for example, on the basis of whether you drive a tanker truck full of gasoline or you drive a tanker truck full of milk. We treat you differently depending on how that is classified. What do we have to find to approve of that? What do we need to be satisfied that that's okay? Do we have to have strict scrutiny where we're really worried that there's something nefarious going on? Mr. Tata? Yeah, we only have to have this lowest level of scrutiny where we say, is there a rational basis? Can the legislature come up with something that sounds as though, well, I don't know if I agree with it or disagree with it, but at least there's a rational basis for it. It's not completely absurd and out of the ballpark. In this case, what is the rational basis offered as to why Mr. Fine doesn't get full compensation, but some victim in an auto accident case does get full compensation? What's the reason for that? Ms. Russell, you talked about that earlier, that the plaintiff is attacking, but the defendants say this is why the legislature made this differentiation. Yeah. And this is exactly what Bill Frist and company are saying about the situation today. Doctors are leaving the medical profession. We have this crisis of rising costs for medical care. It's ruining our health care system. We've got to do something about this crisis or else bad things are going to happen. Now, you pointed out that the plaintiff says this is all smoke and mirrors. There's nothing to it. And the court says, in effect, we're not here to judge the merits of this argument. All we have to find to sustain this legislation is that there's a rational basis for it. Agree or disagree, that's for the legislature to decide. Now, in the middle, just so we fill out our little dance card here, in the middle, we have this thing called, well, what would you have in the middle? You'd have intermediate scrutiny, yeah. And whereas strict scrutiny has to be justified by a compelling state interest, the end of Western civilization really is around the corner. A rational basis is just, hey, if there's something out there that sounds good to somebody, that's okay with us. The intermediate scrutiny, which applies, as you say, to gender or sex discrimination, is an important governmental interest that is narrowly tailored to the remedy. And one of the well-known cases was the Virginia Military Institute case, the VMI case, where the state of Virginia had a separate military academy for men, and then they had other military academies for women, but they by no means were equal. And even at that, the women argued separate but equal didn't work in the area of race. It shouldn't work in the area. And the state of Virginia tried to say, well, gee, there are all these benefits. There are all these reasons why we have a male-only military academy. It's an important governmental interest narrowly tailored. The Supreme Court said, no, we ain't buying it. We don't see that there's enough value to justify this kind of discrimination. So in the VMI case, they said, you have to admit women to the Virginia Military Institute. Now, again, it's not so high that it's strict scrutiny, as though we had two separate academies based on race. There, all of our, suspicions and worries, and we say, in effect, if you're having two separate military academies based on race, we'd say this is has to be established by compelling state interest. Nor is it so unimportant, like tankers of gasoline versus tankers of other things, that we'll just subject it to a rational basis test. Gender discrimination is subjected to this intermediate scrutiny. And again, people look at this and say, well, who dreamed all this up? But how do we know that this is what the Constitution means or should mean or what have you? On the other hand, if you don't like the three-part system, again, what else are you going to do? What are you going to do with the Equal Protection Clause? What does it mean? How does it apply? Yeah. Well, after Lawrence versus Texas, it seems as though sexual orientation falls within sort of the strict scrutiny area, that the court has identified that as a form of discrimination where, you know, it's of sort of, the state has to have a compelling state interest to explain why it's treating this activity differently than that activity. And again, you know, the wisdom of doing that has generated a lot of controversy, criticism, etc., which I would be happy to talk about at a later date. But for today, we're done. Q&A, we'll come back in 10 minutes and take questions and answers till noon.